So we all love Pastor Bobby around here, but there is something that Bobby does that makes several of us cringe because it's gross. Bobby has a coffee mug and he drinks coffee out of it every day, but he only washes it maybe every week, maybe every second week. Now he claims because he doesn't put milk or cream into his coffee, there's nothing that's gonna grow in there. But still, the inside of the cup is always stained brown and has black streaks all over it and doesn't look like anybody should really drink anything out of that cup. And yet he proudly carries it around and puts fresh coffee in it and carries on. Now, interestingly, Jesus is going to use the analogy of a dish that is dirty on the inside and clean on the outside to describe the spiritual condition of a group of people that he encounters. And he has some very harsh and direct words for them, telling them that when it comes to the spiritual life, what's on the inside will come out. And so it's on what's on the inside that we need to pay attention to. We're in this series called Journey to the Cross, where we're journeying with Jesus on the road towards Jerusalem, where he knows he's going to be crucified and killed. And along the way, he has all kinds of different encounters with people. He does some teaching. He does some encouragement of people who are truly following him. But he also has these words of condemnation for people who say that they're following him, but their actions are not showing it. And so we're going to be in Luke 11 today, and this story is going to show us that love is the truest test of spiritual growth. Love is the truest test of spiritual growth. So here's the story in Luke 11, verse 37 to 54. When Jesus had finished speaking, a Pharisee invited him to eat with him, so he went in and reclined at the table. But the Pharisee was surprised when he noticed that Jesus did not first wash before the meal. Then the Lord said to him, Now then you Pharisees clean the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside you're full of greed and wickedness. You foolish people! Did not the one who made the outside also make the inside? But now as for what is inside you, be generous to the poor, and everything will be clean for you. Woe to you, Pharisees, because you give a tenth of your mint, rue, and all other kinds of garden herbs, but you neglect justice and the love of God. You should have practiced the latter without leaving the former undone. Woe to you, Pharisees, because you love the most important seats in the synagogues and respectful greetings in the marketplaces. Woe to you, because you are like unmarked graves, which people walk all over without knowing it. One of the experts in the law answered him, Teacher, when you say these things, you insult us also. Now, note here, there's the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. These groups are pretty close together, except teachers of the law are trained lawyers. And this guy is saying, surely you don't lump us in with them. So Jesus, you can soften the blow a little bit. Well, Jesus doesn't. Jesus replied, And you experts in the law, woe to you, because you load people down with burdens they can hardly carry, and you yourselves will not lift one finger to help them. Woe to you, because you build tombs for the prophets, and it was your ancestors who killed them. So you testify that you approve of what your ancestors did. They killed the prophets, and you build their tombs. Because of this, God in his wisdom said, I will send them prophets and apostles, some of whom they will kill and others they will persecute. Therefore, this generation will be held responsible for the blood of all the prophets that has been shed since the beginning of the world, from the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah, who was killed between the altar and the sanctuary. Yes, I tell you, this generation will be held responsible for all of it. Woe to you experts in the law, because you have taken away the key to knowledge. You yourselves have not entered, and you have hindered those who are entering. When Jesus went outside, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law began to oppose him fiercely and to besiege him with questions, waiting to catch him in something he might say. And I think it's safe to say Jesus wasn't invited back to the home of this Pharisee. Now, I don't want to spend too much time actually looking at line by line through what Jesus actually says. We'll do a little bit of that. But I want to bring us to the point of saying, what does this actually mean for us? The reason why this is important to highlight is this is one of the things Jesus thought was important to highlight on his last journey on this earth. You know, it's said that when you know that you're going to die, you focus on the things that are most important. Jesus is focusing on things that are most important, and this is one of them. So the Pharisees are an early sect of Judaism. They were concerned about rules. They were concerned about religious purity. They wanted to purify Israel through following Old Testament laws and then codifying those laws into political laws. So they actually wanted to make what was religious into that which was political. They backed all of this up with religious sanctions. So they were like people, we know people like this, who said, you can only be a Christian if you do this. So let's maybe try some examples. So you can only be a Christian if you support this particular green initiative, for instance. Okay, should Christians care about the earth? Yes, of course they should. But Christians somehow will say this might be the actual law, and this is an issue connected to the law, and they'll say this is the thing you really have to do if you want to be a true Christian, whether it be recycling, whether it be what you think about electric vehicles or don't think about electric vehicles or renewable energy or whatever it is, this is what you have to think in order to be a Christian. Or you are only a true Christian if you hold to this economic policy or this economic framework or this paradigm. And if you don't, then you're not really a true Christian. Now, should Christians be concerned about economics? Of course they should. But sometimes we can make it really specific and complicated. Or maybe you're only a Christian if you support this political candidate, or you don't support that political candidate. If you vote for this party and not that party, then you can be a true Christian. And what we do is we take periphery things and we make them the main thing. And this is what the Pharisees were doing. And in the process, they made things so complicated for people. We'll give an example in a few minutes of just how complicated a simple thing could be. But they made things so complicated so that by the time they were finished, people were just confused. So to highlight this, I'm going to show you a commercial. This commercial is 28 years old, so the video quality is terrible. But it's a commercial that Tiger Woods did with Nike in a series of commercials called Golf Made Simple. Check it out.
And now, Golf's Not Hard with Tiger Woods and the AirZoom T-Range.
Too many people overcomplicate the golf swing. Today, we're going to make it simple. First, place the ball off the inside of your left heel. Second, bend your knees slightly. And finally, keep the left arm straight. Voila, you're on your way to a better golf swing. Of course, you also want to maintain the triangle too, and lead with your hips. And other than taking the club back low and slow, that's all there is to it. As long as you allow your weight to shift to the inside of your right foot, and keep the club face square, and your left heel planted, and the V between your thumb and forefinger pointed to your right shoulder, and the club gripped gently, like a wounded bird, and your left shoulder under your chin, allowing your hands to rotate through the impact area, and maintaining a stable lower body position, while finishing with your belt buckle facing the target with your rear elbow hinge. That should help take the mystery out of the golf swing. This is Tiger Woods, reminding you that we can all be better.
Now, did that help you with your golf swing, or confuse you more? Probably by the end, you were just confused and you didn't know where to start. This is how the Pharisees operated, and this is what Jesus condemns them for. They were making things way too complicated. So some of the specific things here. First, Jesus doesn't wash his hands before dinner, and the Pharisees notice. Now, this hand washing was not to wash your hands. We always tell our kids to go wash their hands before dinner. Full confession, I rarely wash my hands before dinner, but as parents, we're supposed to tell our kids to wash up, right? So we do. And the Pharisees see Jesus doesn't wash. Now, there's specific ways in which this was supposed to happen, including a prescribed amount of water you're supposed to use, depending on if it's one person or two person, or even up to and beyond 10 people, how much water is supposed to be used. The amount of water is not enough to clean your hands. It was just a matter of symbolizing this kind of spiritual purity. Look how spiritual we are because we're washing our hands. And Jesus says to them, you guys are so superficial. You're doing this act that makes it look like you're so clean, but on the inside, you're as dirty as Bobby's coffee mug. You're full of greed. You're full of malice. You're full of all kinds of unclean things. And Jesus denounces their hypocrisy. It's almost like, we hope we don't run into this in our building renovation here at the church, but you've seen those home renovation shows where they're starting to take apart a wall and they're really just gonna put new drywall and new paint on. And as they take the drywall off, they realize the wall is completely rotten inside. And now all of a sudden they have to rebuild the whole thing from the inside out. That's what Jesus is saying. You guys are rotten on the inside. We need to do the work deep down inside of you so that your outside actions actually match what's inside. So he denounces them for their hypocrisy. He doesn't denounce the practice. He doesn't tell them to stop washing their hands. But he urges them towards justice and towards God's love. Tithing is the next thing. Again, he doesn't denounce them for tithing, giving 10% back to God. They're doing this on the smallest of things. They're paying so much attention to the minutiae, though, that they have forgotten about God's justice. They've forgotten about God's love. They've forgotten about people. And so in their desire to follow the letter of the law, they've forgotten about the more important matters of justice and mercy. As Leon Morris says, when people concentrate on the trivial, they're apt to overlook the important. That's what the Pharisees are doing. They take pride in their positions. They want to sit in the most important seats, and they want to be greeted respectfully out in public. They're more concerned about being seen than they're concerned about serving. Jesus says they're like tombs. He says they're like unmarked graves that people walk over without knowing it. Now, according to the law, contact with a dead body, including walking over an unmarked grave, meant that you were unclean for 7 days. And therefore, there were some restrictions on how you could participate in community life. In springtime in Israel, they would actually whitewash tombstones so that you could see them better, so you wouldn't accidentally walk over somebody's grave and become ceremonially unclean. Jesus says to the Pharisees, people's interactions with you leave them worse off than if they had walked over an unmarked grave. You are leaving people in a spiritually worse place than they were then when they came to you because of how complicated you are making things and because you are completely forgetting about loving people. Now, the teachers of the law, like I said, these are lawyers, and Jesus says they load people down with burdens and they hinder those trying to enter the kingdom. So here's an example. On the Sabbath, you weren't supposed to work, so you weren't supposed to carry things. And so the scribes or the teachers of the law said, what does this mean? What are you allowed to do and what are you not allowed to do? So the law was that you were not allowed to carry anything in your right hand or in your left hand or on your shoulders. But they said, you can carry something on the back of your hand. You can carry something in your foot or with your mouth or with your elbow or in your ear or in your hair or in your wallet, as long as the mouth of the wallet is open downward and not up. You could carry something between your wallet and your shirt, in your hem of your shirt or in your shoe or in your sandal. All those things are okay. But don't use your right hand, your left hand, or your shoulders. You see how this is complicated, right? And it becomes manifoldly more complicated when you think of how many laws there were and then how many surrounding laws there were to support those laws. There's even a reflection in the Mishnah. The Mishnah is a collection of Jewish writings and wisdom that suggests it's actually more important to follow the scribal law, that is the laws that have been created around the actual laws, than it is to obey the laws themselves. Because the law itself might leave room for interpretation, but the scribes, the teachers of the law, they've interpreted it for you. So you have to follow this law. That's what's most important. So you can see how this is challenging. You can see how this is not helping people who are interested in following God. You can see how it's hindering people from actually coming to faith. Okay, so what about us? How might we be like the Pharisees? So in 2013, Barna, which is a research institute that studies the state of Christianity, mostly in America, but also in the world, they did a study in which they tried to give some empirical data to answer the question, are Christians hypocrites? Are they Pharisees? And so what they did was they asked 1,000 people 20 questions. And the 20 questions were yes or no questions, and they fell into 4 categories. I'm going to read them all for you. Now, before I read them, I want to say this is a helpful study, but maybe not a perfect study. If I was to write these statements, that maybe I would have wrote them a little bit differently than they did. But nonetheless, there's something we can see here. So the first category, there's 4 categories in these 20 questions. The first category was questions about actions like Jesus. These questions are yes or no. You can answer them in your own head as I read them. Number one, I listen to others to learn their story before telling them about my faith. Number two, in recent years, I have influenced multiple people to consider following Christ. Number three, I regularly choose to have meals with people with very different faith or morals than me. Number four, I try to discover the needs of non-Christians rather than waiting for them to come to me. And number five, I am personally spending time with non-believers to help them follow Jesus. Second category is attitudes that are like Jesus. Yes or no questions. Number one, I see God-given value in every person, regardless of their past or present condition. Number two, I believe God is for everyone. Number three, I see God working in people's lives even when they're not following Him. Number four, it's important to help people know God is for them than to make sure they know they are sinners. Number five, I feel compassion for people who are not following God and who are doing immoral things. All right, the third category is about self-righteous actions or Pharisaical actions. Number one, I tell others the most important thing in my life is following God's rules. Number two, I don't talk about my sins or struggles. That's between me and God. Number three, I try to avoid spending time with people who are openly gay or lesbian. Number four, I like to point out those who do not have the right theology or doctrine. Number five, I prefer to serve people who attend my church rather than those outside the church. And then the fourth category, questions about self-righteous or Pharisaical attitudes. Number one, I find it hard to be friends with people who constantly do the wrong things. Number two, it's not my responsibility to help people who don't help themselves. Number three, I feel grateful to be a Christian when I see other people's failures and flaws. Number four, I believe we should stand against those who are opposed to Christian values. And number five, people who follow God's rules are better than those who don't. Now, out of that, they made a grid with four quadrants. In the bottom left quadrant, they had people who were Pharisaical both in action and in attitude. In the top left, people who were Pharisaical in attitude, but Christ-like in their actions. In the bottom right, people who are Christ-like in their attitudes, but Pharisaical in their actions. And then in the top right, people who are Christ-like in both attitude and action. Guess out of the 1,000 people they surveyed, how many people fit into the bottom left category? Pharisaical in attitude and actions. Unfortunately, the percentage there is 51%. 51% demonstrated Pharisaical actions and attitudes. Now, this is data on a page, and maybe we would tweak the questions a little bit differently, but it tells us something, doesn't it? Now, they broke this down into different subgroups, so Catholics, Protestants, nominal Christians, and then evangelicals. So we might identify ourselves most with the evangelical category. So how many in the bottom left, just in the evangelical category, still far too high, 38%. And they actually found that of all of these subgroups of Christianity, evangelicals were the most likely to be Christ-like in action, but Pharisaical in attitude. They were doing the right things, but they were doing them with the wrong motives, in the wrong heart. Isn't that exactly what the Pharisees were? They were doing the right things, but Jesus says you're not actually doing them for the right reasons. Lots of people today do the right things, but don't have the right heart behind them. They go to church every week. Maybe they even give money. Maybe they serve in a ministry. Maybe they read their Bible every day. Maybe they pray every once in a while, but their heart's really not in it. And really, all it is for them is an insurance policy that ensures they go to heaven when they die. They're not really concerned about other people. David Kinnaman, who was the president of Barna, wrote a book called Unchristian. And in his book, he discovered that 84% of non-Christians, in the data that he collected, 84% of non-Christians said that they knew a Christian personally. But only 15% of those Christians said that the lifestyles of those believers were noticeably different in a good way. Only 15% said that their Christian friends, their lives were actually attractive to them. Doesn't that seem wrong? Doesn't it seem that if we are followers of Jesus and have been transformed by the grace that Jesus has offered to us, much like Zacchaeus was last week in the story we studied, shouldn't it be true that our lives just exude something that other people would be drawn to? Shouldn't it be true that we are people of peace and contentment in such a deep way that people can see it? I mean, don't you know someone like that, a believer who just seems so grounded and so at peace and so full of I don't know, it's even hard to put your finger on it. It's contentment, but and it's joy and it's peace and it's like it's all of that kind of wrapped up. And you say, oh, I wish I had that. Shouldn't that describe more of us as Christians? As we experience the joy of the Lord in our lives, as the fruit of the Spirit is grown in us and we become more loving and peaceful and patient and so on and so forth. Shouldn't people be drawn to that? And yet many Christians settle for just following the rules. And this actually hinders us in our evangelism because we're actually more concerned about being right than we are about entering the mess of other people's lives and inviting them to follow Jesus starting where they are. We actually ask people to behave before they can belong, when we actually need to invite people to belong before they can behave, and then maybe eventually they'll believe. But we get this backwards. So what does Jesus command the Pharisees to do? So he's criticized them on these various things. The counterpoints he gives them are to practice generosity, to be concerned with justice, to be humble, to repent, and to love mercy. So how might we summarize all of these things? Well, Jesus did that already for us. Mark chapter 12, verse 28. One of the teachers of the law came and heard them debating. Noticing that Jesus had given them a good answer, he said, "Of all the commandments, which is most important?" "The most important one," answered Jesus, "is this: Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. The second is this: love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these." "Well said, teacher," the man replied. "You are right in saying that God is one and there is no other but him. To love him with all your heart, with all your understanding, and with all your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself is more important than all burnt offerings and sacrifices, than following the rules." When Jesus saw he had answered wisely, he said to him, "You are not far from the kingdom of God." And from then on, no one dared ask him any more questions. Jesus summarizes all of the rules by saying the most important thing you need to do is to love God and to love people. Love God and love people. Now, if we're honest, there's a little part of us that reacts against that and say, well, what about the rules, right? Like, there are clear boundaries, right, of what makes a person a Christian and what makes a person not a Christian. Shouldn't we enforce those boundaries and keep people out who don't actually belong in? What if we got loose with our morality and our boundaries around what's right and what's wrong? I don't really think Jesus is talking so much about forgetting about all the rules. He's saying loving God and loving people is the fulfillment of all those rules. It's what all those rules are leading to. So yes, there are boundaries of morality that are important for us to continue to maintain, especially in a world that continually crowds upon the church and constantly pressures us to change our thinking in a lot of different areas. But couldn't we demonstrate love to people who are different than us in a way that makes following Jesus look really appealing to people? John Mark Comer, in his book, Practicing the Way, says, "Love is the metric of spiritual maturity, not discipline. Discipline is a means to an end." So discipline's really good, right? Spending time with God every day, practicing our spiritual gifts, prayer, fasting, solitude, all the disciplines, they're really good. But they're a means to an end, to be with Jesus, to become like him, and to do what he did. Comer says, "I know some people who never miss a week of church, who read through the entire Bible every year and never watch R-rated movies, these are all good things, but who are still self-righteous, controlling, fueled by anger, blind to their own shadow, and at times incredibly unloving. And I know others who are in a season of just trying to survive parenting little kids and barely getting 10 minutes a day to pray. But tired as they may be, they are becoming more loving with each passing year. Love is the truest test of spiritual growth. So if you look back at yourself 1 year ago and compare yourself to today, are you more loving now than you were then? Or maybe look back 5 years. Are you more loving now than you were then? If the answer is yes, then it's very, very likely that you have been growing spiritually in that time. If the answer is no, then maybe your focus has been in the wrong place. We'll close with this illustration, bring it back to golf. I love golf. I like to go. There's nothing better than the feeling of hitting a drive straight and long down the fairway, or watching a long putt miraculously roll in, or an approach shot that sticks close to the pin. These are just great feelings. Keeps you coming back for more, even though there's so many bad shots mixed in with the good ones. Listen, I could watch so much online about golf. I could watch tutorials about every conceivable thing under the sun. I could research what kind of clubs I should use. I should watch videos about how to hit shots out of the bunker, how to hit shots when the ball's above my feet or below my feet or out of the rough or out of the fairway, how to putt better, how to drive straighter, how to put shape into my shots. I could research like all day, every day. I could watch more and I could learn more and I could know a lot. But if I never get my clubs and drive to the course and step onto the first tee, does it really mean anything? I mean, I could tell all kinds of people about what they should do when they play golf because I know so much about it. But if I'm never actually doing it myself, it rings hollow. So here's the challenge for this week. Here's how you can put this into practice. Love is the truest test of spiritual growth. So how are you demonstrating love to others? How are you demonstrating love to God? What are the ways in which you are walking in love? So here's the specific challenge. I want you to pick someone in your life that's very difficult for you to love. And I want you to show them love in an intentional way this week. Doesn't have to be huge, but show them love. The love of Christ, which is in you. Not because you have to, not because you have the wrong motives, but because you know that love is the genuine sign, the genuine marker that you are growing in spiritual growth. May we love one another well. Let's pray. Jesus, I thank you for your word, which instructs us and challenges us. And honestly, we can see a bit of ourselves in the Pharisees. We have at times been too self-righteous. We have looked down upon other people. We have been too concerned about being right. And we have not been concerned enough about showing your love to a world that desperately needs it. So Lord, I pray that you would help us to love you well, that every day we would grow more and more in love with you. And I pray that we would love others well, even when it's hard to do. Would you help us to demonstrate your love to the world so that they might see it and be drawn to you because we have loved so well? In Christ's name, amen.